Hello and welcome to Essential Knowledge Updates or EKU podcasts from the Royal College of General Practitioners. My name is Dr. Thomas Round and I'm the EKU clinical lead. And today I'm talking to a colleague and friend of mine, Dr. Sally Higginbottom. And Sally is a GP and interested in women's health.
I do. So I fit coils and implants and I'm a faculty registered trainer for the Diploma of Sexual and Reproductive Health and the Letters of Competence. So I have a bit of an interest in both education and in women's health.
Today we're talking about a recent EKU module on oral contraception.
That's right. We're discussing an article from the BJGP last year, which talked about oral contraception, which obviously covers both combined oral contraception with an estrogen and androgestogen in it and progesterone only pills.
GPs like me and trainees may not be doing the contraception pill so often. I mean, I've found now a lot of that work has gone to the practice nurse and the pharmacist. So I think it'd be useful maybe we go through some of the basics, if that would be okay, around prescribing the pill. And we'll be clear demarcation that we won't be talking about long-acting contraception today, but there's some great top tips and modules on the college website.
Absolutely. So a lot of the day-to-day contraceptive work is now done by our colleagues, but we will be asked when there's a problem or to troubleshoot. And we may also be looking after some of our more complex patients, perhaps patients we're seeing for a severe mental illness review or a learning disability review. So we need to understand how it all works.
Exactly. So that's our supervision, colleagues asking questions. Or last time I did it was a complex consultation where contraception was part of that consultation, including mental health and other issues. And I think patient also had some period pain. So I would find often it will be people coming in, not necessarily for contraception, maybe around period pains or irregular cycle, dysfunctional bleeding, that we'd have that discussion around the pill. Is that in your practice as well?
Absolutely. So we use the pills not only for contraception, but also for other related gynecological problems, as you mentioned, or even sometimes for mood disorders for some women. So it might be helpful if we set out our stall at the start, if we think about pills in terms of combined pills and progesterone only pills, and then the progesterone only pills are what we call traditional pills, which are the ones that used to be called a mini pill, and the desogestrel pills like Cerazette, which are a newer sort of progesterone only pill that most of us would now use first line because they have a longer window. So if we think of them as three separate sorts of pills, that's a good place to start.
That's great. Thank you, Sally. And yeah, I guess it's patient preference discussing the different options and also that risk assessment is so important, isn't it?
It is. So on a practical prescribing note, there's a couple of things I'd suggest. The first is that you always prescribe by brand name, which is very different to how we prescribe in other conditions and with other medications. That's because each particular sort of pill can have all sorts of different brands and it causes quite a lot of confusion, both prescribers and patients, that the generic names can be very difficult to get your heads around. So prescribe by brand. And when you start thinking about pill options, for most women, a combined pill is going to give them better cycle control than a progesterone only pill. So for most women, you're going to want to start to think about prescribing with a combined pill, but it has more contraindications than a progesterone only pill, which has very few contraindications at all. That's my starting point.
That's a great starting point. Do PRP has any kind of vascular risk? I'm always under the impression that very low or minimal, if any, VT or cardiovascular risks with the PRP.
That's right. There's no measurable risk in terms of venous thromboembolism or ischemic heart disease or stroke with a progesterone-only pill used as a progesterone-only pill. However, just as an aside, if you're using big doses of norethisterone to delay a period, for example, which is a very different dosage, that has a similar risk as a combined pill. So don't be lulled into a false sense of security that all progesterones in any dose have no associated risk. But in a contraceptive pill, there is no associated cardiovascular risk, which is what makes them safe to use in women who've got multiple risk factors for coronary artery disease or venous thromboembolism and right up to the age of 55.
That's a really good tip. Thank you. So we'd be therefore thinking, really looking at the patient age, their risk factors, comorbidity, blood pressure, BMI. I mean, that's the checklist that I have in my mind when thinking about a contraceptive pill and also what the patient preference is.
Absolutely. There are things to think about in terms of how pills are taken as well. So traditionally, combined pills would have been taken for 21 days and then 7 days break, which was a plan to create the impression of a regular cycle. Of course, it's not really a regular cycle, but that was the impression you get if you have a bleed every month. But that's completely unnecessary. So most pills we would now advise women to take continually or continually for three packs and then a break because you get a lower failure rate and actually fewer withdrawal bleeds that women might call periods. And so that's something worth thinking about how you take it. The progesterone only pill you must take every day. Don't stop taking it. And so if you're changing someone from a combined pill to a progesterone only pill, that is a point that needs very clear repetition to avoid an accident.
Can you just talk about the phasing of the combined pills? Sure, it's not news to everyone, but some people may not feel confident in doing that or advising women about how to use it. So what are tips on that and how you discuss that with a patient?
So you have to explain that what you're suggesting is not what it will say in the box, which confuses women. So I say that explicitly. I also try to avoid prescribing the pills that have the dummy pills in them, because that just adds to the confusion. So if you're going to want someone to take them continually, don't give them sugar pills in the pack. And most sorts of pills, for example, microgynon will come everyday version, which will say ED when you prescribe, and that has 7 dummy pills in it. And there's a non-ED version, which just has 21 real pills in it. So my first tip would be to prescribe something that's only got the medicine in it. And then to explain why we got to the point where women were prescribed this 21-7 split, and that it's not actually necessary biologically. It's absolutely fine to do it that way if that's what a woman wants. But often they're very happy when you say, actually, you could take 3 packets in a row. So you'll take 9 weeks of active pills and then have a bleed. So you'll have 1 bleed every 10 weeks instead of 1 every 4. Or you can take it continuously till you start spotting and then stop for a week or maybe even 4 days, have a bleed and then restart. And that can control irregular bleeding quite well.
That's really interesting because I've done the 3-month one, but I wasn't really aware of that continue till you spot. Is there any evidence on that? And what's the average if a woman's saying, well, how long might that be? Is there any data on that that helps support that decision making?
So it's very, very variable with individual women. I sometimes suggest they try it. For some women, they just end up getting a lot of breakthrough bleeding and it's too long for them. And that's absolutely fine. And some women prefer to have a predictability about it. So going for, say, 3 packets and then a bleed gives them that predictability. I also consider using a lower dose pill. So our standard pills are usually 30 micrograms, but there are 20 microgram pills out there. And if we're going to use them continually, it seems like a reasonable bet, though not from a big evidence base. In our usual way that we try to use the lowest effective dose of whatever we're using, seems a reasonable thing to do. And particularly if we're doing that, we reduce the pill-free interval to 4 days rather than 7 to avoid any early ovulation at the end of that period. Actually, quite a lot of flexibility now.
That's a really good top tip. You mentioned microgynon. I think in our area, we have a switch, which seems to just auto do people to the cheapest brand. So I guess every area has a different formulary and maybe some tips on the prescribing.
Yeah, so some people who are as old as me will remember the big pill scare that happened in the 90s. And that was around a 3rd generation progestogen. So the progestogens are all artificial synthetic versions of progesterone, which were used initially because we couldn't get the sort of progesterone that was the same as the progesterone women make in their bodies, was broken down and so couldn't be absorbed orally. We might get some progress on that. Now we use utrogestin in HRT, but there's nothing like that yet licensed in contraception. So we have different generations of progestogens. The first generation was norethisterone, which is pretty mucky stuff, really. And I think most people who do a lot of women's health are not very keen on norethisterone. It has a lot of side effects, both progestogenic and androgenic side effects. The second generation pills contain levonorgestrel, and they are in most areas first-line pills. So that's microgynon, lowgynon, and there are other similar pills that are levonorgestrel pills. Third generation pills were what the big scares were, concerned people, and the things like Mercilon, Marvelon. They can be quite useful for women who have side effects with microgynon. And then fourth generation pills contain particularly drosperinone, which is Yasmin and Yaz, which are very popular. They're the most popular pills worldwide, which probably reflects very, very effective marketing rather than anything specific. But they are particularly skin friendly. So for women who have acne, polycystic ovarian syndrome, premenstrual syndrome, they are particularly good. They are more expensive, but none of these drugs are expensive. Compared with a lot of what we use, these drugs are not expensive. And personally, I would push back at the script switch argument for these sorts of drugs, because the cost of an unplanned pregnancy because someone's pills arrived in a different box with some sugar pills in them this month and they didn't realise is going to outweigh any number of patients where you've saved £1.27 by moving them from one form to another.
Totally agree. That's really good tips on prescribing. And you mentioned a bit about side effects of these drugs. And a lot of women worry, often women are a little bit frightened to take the pill. They've heard rumours from friends or family that about side effects. Do you have discussion with a patient or some stock phrases that you use?
Yeah, so as you say, most women get on very well with the pill. It has a lot of non-contraceptive benefits, as you talked about, particularly around periods. Period pain and period heaviness are usually helped hugely, certainly by a combined pill and often also by a progesterone-only pill. It's also helpful in terms of long-term health to think about the long-term health advantages as well as the long-term health risks. We know that there's a small increased risk of venous thromboembolism and a small increased risk of breast cancer in current users. But there's also a reduction in ovarian cancer and reduction in osteoporosis. They have their benefits as well. So there is a balance to be struck. If we just want to think about the numbers for venous thromboembolism, a non-pregnant woman who's not on the pill might have a risk of about 2 in 10,000 women years. If you're on the highest risk pill, in inverted commas, you might have a risk of 9 to 12 per 10,000 women years. But being pregnant or postnatal will be higher than that still. So it's still very helpful in terms of total risk to be on the pill.
Oh, yes. One of these really good teaching materials that we use for looking at relative and absolute risk. So the scaremongering, I kind of remember this in the 90s as well. The scaremongering was about doubling or trebling risk, but that was looking at the relative rather than the absolute risk.
Exactly. The absolute risk for a fit young woman remains low. For someone who perhaps is a smoker, has a first degree family history of thromboembolism, that's a different discussion. So I'm not dismissing the concerns. And we should all be familiar with the medical eligibility for contraception, the MEC. It's very clear. It's one of the very few areas of primary care, I think, that has such nice, clear rules that guide us. So if something is MEC 1, it's fine to use. If it's MEC 2, the benefits outweigh the risk. MEC 3, you want to be thinking really carefully about, I wouldn't prescribe that unless I was very clear that it was their best option in a tight spot and I'd sought advice. And MEC 4, you just don't ever do.
That's really helpful. That's based on the Faculty of Sexual and Reproductive Health guidelines. That's easy to navigate to.
Yeah, it's on their website. It's very clear. All of their guidance I find very helpful. There's a summary document at the start of each of their big set of guidelines, which is just 2 or 3 pages with all the headlines. And then if you want to dig into the evidence, that's all in the document behind. But they do try quite hard to be very clear on the summary pages.
And I would say in our module online, we have a nice table, which is a quiz about UK MEC. So have a look at that. And also trainees might want to have a look at that in detail in case it comes up in exams or anything like that.
I always tell my trainees that contraceptive use makes a very good topic for exams because there are strict rules around it. And if you're trying to Absolutely. Write multiple choice questions, for example, quite hard to do that across a lot of general practice because a lot of what we do exists in the grey rather than the clear absolutely. Black and white. Whereas this stuff, there are clear rules around.
So, yeah, we touched on both of the COCP and the POP. Maybe we could talk a little bit more in detail about two different types of POP. I mean, I use Cerazette as front and center as my main POP pill. As you said, the 12-hour window, daily taking, mention around spotting, kind of mention that normally settles down. Is that right to say that?
That's right. So desogestrel, Cerazette, progesterone only pill is for most of us first line, and I think should be. There's not actually evidence it has a lower failure rate than the traditional POP, but it just seems fairly obvious given the difference between a 12-hour window and a 3-hour window, and because it prevents ovulation as opposed to having just effects on cervical mucus. So in terms of bleeding patterns, there's actually some quite useful evidence now. So about 4 in 10 desogestrel progesterone only pill users will have normal frequency bleeding. 2 or 3 in 10 will be amenorrheic, and that's completely fine. I've quite often sent people who just say, my periods have stopped, and you discover that there's a clear reason why their periods have stopped. They're on Cerazette, and that's fine. About 1 in 10 will have frequent bleeding, and 1 in 10 will have prolonged bleeding. So it's similar to the implant in some ways. I always say 4 out of 5 will be really happy with this. They'll either have regular light bleeds or no bleeds at all. About 1 in 5 will have annoying bleeding. The
really
traditional
helpful.
POP, we don't use much now, and I would only use if I was a little bit up against it with someone perhaps who couldn't have a combined pill, had side effect on a desogestrel pill, but still needed something, particularly perhaps at the end of the reproductive span. So a woman in her late 40s, early 50s just wants a bit of something. I think it's a reasonable call for that.
We talked about pill regimes. What about missed pills? I think I have this pattern that once you remember, take it straight away. And it also, I think, as you said, with the POP, you've got a 12-hour window. With the combined, it depends where in the cycle. Is that right?
It does. I find this quite tricky because the rules are now more generous but more complicated. So there's actually really good flow charts on the Faculty of Sexual and Reproductive Health site, and I have those printed out and I work my way through them periodically. The critical point is the thing that puts you at risk with a combined pill is extending the pill-free interval. So if you have a 7-day pill-free interval, you're very unlikely to have ovulated by the end of it. If that goes up to 8 or 9 days, or sort of goes up to 8 or 9 days because you missed pills either side of the pill-free interval, it's much higher risk. So you can work your way logically through the flowchart, and that's fine. But the thing to stress with patients is that you don't want to miss your pills either side of that break. If you miss a couple of pills in the middle, nothing will happen. But it's another reason why we quite like the prolonged regimes, because it solves all this problem.
There's less of that pill-free interval, isn't there? And I think also what's changed my practice, definitely with the pandemic, using tools like AccuRx, send information on contraception and send flowcharts and other information, because we know that patients probably take half of what we talk about in a consultation in.
Yes.
Maybe less.
Absolutely.
So I think it's really good to summarize and use tools to help women feel empowered to understand what they're doing, have a personalized plan for them.
Absolutely. And it's worth thinking, while we're thinking about emergency contraception, a copper coil is always your best bet. So if a woman's missed pills and is at risk and really doesn't want to get pregnant, always offer a copper coil. But assuming they don't want that, do think very carefully about the choice between a Levonorgestrel emergency contraception and an Ulipristal emergency contraception, because Ulipristal is a progesterone blocker. At least that's how I explain it to women. So not only will it interfere with the pill, but the pill will interfere with it. So progesterones will make it less effective. So it's just an extra thing to be thoughtful about if you're prescribing emergency contraception to a woman who's taking the pill.
We're now moving towards 6 months or longer prescribing, sometimes 12 months. Is that happening into routine practice?
Even better than that. The national guidance is 12 months from initiation. So, yep. Hello, I'd like the pill. I'm low risk. Everything's fine. Great. Here's a year. We'll see you in a year. That's it. So I occasionally run audits in my practice to just have a quick look at how we're doing with that, because no one should really be on 3 or 6 month prescriptions unless there's a really good reason to bring someone back. So if someone was a bit borderline in terms of risk and you wanted to just see how they got on with it, then that's reasonable. But beyond that, please give them a year and send them on their way. The risks of running out greatly exceed the risks of carrying on for almost all women.
In my practice, probably a lot of other people's practice, a lot of the reviews now, as we said, nurse-led, pharmacist-led, with the wider primary care teams.
Oh, completely. Yes, this is a good topic in a contained way for people to be skilled up in their training. One of the reasons they've moved to an annual check is because the evidence is it's much better to do an annual check properly once a year than it is to do half-hearted, no one's really interested checks every 3 months or 6 months. So they should have a proper discussion every year. And that should include a clear question as to whether is the pill the best option for you. And I say that because while we're talking about pills today, the failure rate in real life use of pills is perhaps 9 women in a year will get pregnant out of 100 who are taking a pill. It's quite a high risk. So if it's important for someone not to get pregnant, we should offer them every time a coil or an implant as a form of long-acting reversible contraception. Just keep it in as an option in people's
minds. I mean, we did used to have the little tick boxes talk about LARC. We're not talking about that in detail today, but it's so important to mention that at every contact.
That's right. Just make sure it's in the narrative. And I think access has made a big difference. And we've got actually quite good access to LARC now across most areas. But changing the narrative in people's minds that contraception equals the pill or a condom, because there's actually quite a lot of other options. We won't go into all of the other options, but there are other options we should make sure people are aware of so they can choose the best thing for them.
And I think there's really good tips. So, I mean, the NHS website's got a really nice introductory pages to contraception. Yes, it's in English, but I work in a city in London with lots of different ethnicities, but most people have access to someone who can help translate it into English. And it gives some really good overviews of the different types of contraception, particularly maybe you have women who have low health literacy, maybe from overseas, English not the first language. So we need to help support them in making an informed choice.
Absolutely. And contraceptionchoices.org is my favourite go-to option that has lovely infographics. So low words, high pictures, nice and clear, and together with videos, which can often be helpful as well.
And that's contraception.org, did you say?
That's contraceptionchoices.org. You'll like it, Thomas. It's a UCL.
Great. That's really helpful. Project. Thank you.
So it has images which show you how many women will get pregnant every year, but also videos on questions like, do I need a break from hormones? The answer is essentially no, that kind of thing.
And any sort of top tips? I guess also, what's the future direction of travel in this area? If there's any new drugs on the horizon, maybe.
Absolutely. So a couple of top tips. There has been discussion in the past about giving women over 70 kilograms double dose of the POP. There's no evidence that's necessary or sensible, so don't do that. Women who've had bariatric surgery, we just don't know how well oral contraception will work because of absorption issues. So we would suggest a non-oral form of contraception for them. And remember, don't worry. If a woman is approaching menopausal age and you're wanting to check an FSH, that will work if they're on a progesterone-only pill, but it won't work if there are an estrogen-containing pill, because the estrogen will affect the feedback loop, essentially. So you'll get a falsely reduced FSH. So those are my things not to forget. There is an exciting new pill coming, I understand. So it's going to be based on drosperinone, which is the progestogen that's in Yasmin. But it's going to be a progesterone-only pill that is taken for 21 days and then 4-day break. And so there'll be a regular bleed cycle. It's like spironolactone. I think there'll be a lot more information coming out about that, because that could be a real game changer. So a progesterone-only pill that doesn't have the risks associated with estrogen-containing compounds, but that doesn't have the bleeding irregularity associated with progesterone-only pills. And of course, will also potentially be good for skin if it's anti-androgen like spironolactone. It could be quite an exciting new pill. So watch this space. It's in the guidance, but my understanding is it's not yet available.
Thank you, Sally. Just one thought. You mentioned a little bit around perimenopause. If women are getting perimenopausal symptoms, maybe under 50, do you sometimes use the combined pill rather than the standard HRT products? Because it is, in a way, HRT, estrogen and progesterone.
So if a woman needs contraception and it has premature ovarian insufficiency or early menopause, then once you use a combined pill, or of course a Mirena plus some transdermal estrogen. But that's absolutely right. You can use either if you're just looking for hormone replacement. As a woman becomes closer to 50 and the other side of 50, the estrogen and progestogens in HRT are probably more friendly in terms of your risk profile as women get older. So I wouldn't keep someone on a combined pill into late 40s and early 50s unless you've got a particular reason. You can use a combined pill to 50, but I have to say, practically speaking, there's usually a better option for most women post 40, 45.
That's great. Thanks, Sally. And just to flag up, please do look at our website, got the contraception module there. There's also other contraception modules going through LARCs, long-acting contraception, on the website as well. So please do have a look at that. Thank you very much, Sally, for that discussion today. Really helpful, and hopefully some top tips for people into their practice.
It's an absolute pleasure, Thomas. Thanks so much.
You're listening to the RCGP Essential Knowledge Updates podcast. Thank you for listening.